Hello there. I think I might have ghosted you all. I'm sure the function room isn't the first, nor will it be the last, to just stop without explanation, but it's poor form all the same to just not do any more episodes and then not say a word. So officially, I'm putting the podcast on hiatus for a while and releasing these last two episodes. I'm doing that for two reasons. Number one, I just wasn't giving it the time that it deserved to properly promote it, and that really felt like a disservice to the brilliant guests who've given me their time. And second, I wasn't making it the best it could be. When you're doing everything yourself in a podcast, researching, producing, editing, promoting, oh yeah, there's loads of creative freedom, but it's also wrong for two reasons. There isn't the time to make it as good as it can be, and you don't benefit from others' good ideas. So I'm parking it for a while. I've got a few other things on. I've got a book coming out in autumn, which is about how we speak English in Ireland. And also, I've been asked to be on a new podcast with journalist and author Aoife Moore, a Derry woman who is a brilliant and powerful voice in news and media right now. We do a weekly show on the news, but try to bring a bit of a light touch to it. I kind of come in with some gags. She's got the actual proper stuff. And someone else is doing the editing and the promoting. And I've already done five episodes in the time it would take me to stare at a blank page and agonize over an intro. So that podcast is called A Few Scoops. It's available on Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And if I can sneak any mathematical stories in there in any shape or form, I will. But I would like to restart the function room again at a future stage, maybe with a co-host, a change in format, get someone in to produce, and just generally do it better, because it has been a chance for me to interview some of the smartest, most interesting people out there. In the meantime, there are two episodes left that I recorded over the last while, and I should have released before this, but I was just hiding. You know those tasks, that the longer you leave them, the harder it is to do. So for goodness sake, Colm, get those two brilliant episodes out, because they're two very interesting people. The one you're about to listen to now is with the author of one of my favourite books. It's called The Knowledge, How to Rebuild Our World from Scratch. He's Lewis Dartnell. He's an astrobiologist. He's got a string of bestsellers to his name, Demystifying Science, Making Things Accessible. And this book is a fascinating tour of what you need to rebuild to make a civilization, and therefore what makes a civilization. And then the maths angle of it is that we just talk about the key numbers that keep us alive on the planet. How much land do you need? What temperature to sterilize things? How to make penicillin? All that kind of stuff. And what to do if it all falls apart? And also, what happens to abstract concepts like mathematics when the lights go out? Do we forget everything? Or is there something inside our heads that remembers the glory years, the golden age, before the current dark age? Now, we don't have an apocalypse yet, just in case you're wondering. So you can enjoy this in a nice what-if kind of way. Unless you're listening to this and there has been an apocalypse, in which case it might be useful, and go dig out that book from underneath the rubble. Anyway, this is Lewis Dartnell. Enjoy.
I'm Lewis Dartnell. I'm a research scientist at the University of Westminster and a book author.
And yeah, speaking of books, first of all, it's very good of you to come on the function room to talk about a book from way back when. I write books myself, and there is always that element of, thank you for asking me about this really old book. I'm kind of trying to sell another.
This thing I'm struggling to think back to and remember. Yeah.
Yeah. So I appreciate that. I've just started Being Human, which I really like, and hopefully we'll talk about that another time. In general, why do you write books that endeavor to answer such huge questions as what it means to be human, or in the case of this, the knowledge from, I think it's 2014, what would happen if everything ended? What is the motivation to tackle a topic like that?
I mean, it's a straightforward, simple answer. It's curiosity, to be honest. And with all of my books I've written so far, so The Knowledge was book three, and my most recent book, Being Human, was book five. And for all of those books, I've written the book that I really wanted to read myself and then realised it didn't exist yet. So I, you know, sat down, did the two and a half years of researching and writing and then editing the book, just because I love exploring new ideas. You know, it's as much a hobby as anything else for me.
And the kind of subheading for the knowledge, which is the one you're kindly talking to me about, is how to rebuild our world after an apocalypse. Were you sitting around looking at ordinary things around you and thinking, we take this for granted, how would you make it from scratch? Was there a trigger for it?
Yeah, no, exactly that. So I think I should be very clear, very plain right from the beginning. I'm not a prepper. I'm not a survivalist. I haven't stockpiled months of canned food and sort of water purification tablets. I live in West London with about 3 days of food at any particular time. But as a scientist, I want to explore behind the scenes of the modern world and see where everything comes from. All this stuff we just take for granted. Where does it come from? How is it made? How could you do that for yourself if you ever needed to? And I thought a good conceit, a good premise to explore this was just imagine you wake up tomorrow and it's all gone. There's been some kind of largely unspecified apocalypse. The vast majority of the human race has disappeared. Civilization, as we know, has collapsed. And you're left to your own devices or that of your post-apocalyptic survival community. And it's all about exploring, like, say, this sort of lost knowledge. You know, generations in the past, people made their own tools. They grew their own food. They repaired things. And we just don't do that anymore. It's a lot of this craft skill that's been lost. And so I wanted to explore, you know, where all that comes from and how you could do it if you ever needed to, if there ever was some kind of hypothetical apocalypse.
The reason I asked you on a mathematics and numbers podcast is that it struck me as reading the book that I am in blissful ignorance of some fundamental numbers and limits and external system conditions that literally define everything about life. And it made all my own little worries so trivial, you know, that there's fundamentally some factors, some almost life constants. And I thought we might talk through, first of all, at a high level, some kind of basics, and then maybe some detailed ones that I hope you don't mind I've picked out of the book that struck me as particularly important. But first of all, in a population, because I think we always like, oh, I'd be fine, I'm just going to go off into the woods. Like, man my age just wants to run off into the woods and live in the hollow in a hollow tree somewhere. But actually, you need people. And the first thing is, how many people in a group do you think would have enough about them to keep going in that hunter-gatherer, raid the empty supermarkets kind of life? And then if you wanted to do a bit more and actually construct some sort of succession, how many would you need for that?
Yeah, so if you were to survive the apocalypse, you could quite happily go off alone, live a sort of solitary existence and survive and forage and scavenge and provide for yourself. But that's not a society. That's not rebuilding a civilization. And it's that angle that I wanted to explore in the knowledge. So the more pertinent question becomes, how many survivors would you need in a particular area? So, you know, they would encounter each other. They would interact with each other. How many survivors would you need so you'd have a good chance of repopulating the world and having enough genetic diversity represented in the survivors? So you don't start encountering problems further down the line. And actually, there's good historical analogues for this. We can look at genetic data from particular populations around the world and understand that process very well. And there's been particular colonization events in the history of the world where people have walked across a land bridge during the last ice age or across the ocean on boats and rafts and colonized an island. And by looking at the genetics of the population that's descended from that, it seems that you would need a few hundred breeding age females because that's what the genetic data tells us about. And so if you've got a few hundred breeding age females, clearly you'd have an equivalent number of males. And you'd also have an entire demographic. You'd have an entire population structure built around that, including older people and children who are not yet contributing to reproduction. So it's looking at studies of populations like the Polynesians who crossed the ocean and settled an island and built up a population from that.
Yeah, it's and that has to leave aside whether they'd get on with each other as well.
Yes, I think we've all seen the film, right? There's I got to be very playful with the knowledge, and there's a lot of sort of tropes and memes that we're familiar with of post-apocalyptic wastelands. And probably many of us have read a book like The Road. We might play computer games like The Last of Us, or we've seen films like Mad Max. You know, this post-apocalyptic world is very alluring. You know, sort of standing on the edge and looking over, like, it's not impossible. Our current civilization could collapse. We could find ourselves in this situation, and it's scary. But then you can finish the book, you can put down your PlayStation controller, finish playing the game, and then you're back in the comforts of the modern world. So it's almost like the same, I guess, same psychology as a roller coaster. You get to scare yourself, but know that it's safe. And a common theme of a lot of these, you know, sort of post-apocalyptic depictions is of violence and lawlessness and chaos. And I think, of course, that would happen. Once society evaporates, I think it's inevitable that people will be mean to each other. It will be dog eat dog. People are fighting for their own survival. But that period won't be indefinite. It will come to conclusion. There will be some re-establishment of order, of leadership. And it's from that point that I pick up the story of the knowledge. I'm not really interested in talking about the science of, you know, running around with shotguns and raiding each other for cans of food. I'm looking at what lies behind the scenes of our civilization. And how could you rebuild that back from the ground up? So we're assuming you've got a society of reasonably peaceful people working together, collaborating together. What are your steps after that?
One area to start with fundamentally is food. Assuming you've raided the supermarkets for a while and all of that, but I've never sat down and considered how much land do I need for food and for heat. For example, in energy, you talk in the book about how you use 14,000 kilowatt hours per year. Looking at our own electricity bills, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
But I never thought about it. Like, what is the energy required that you have to put in to get the energy out? Or what is the energy required to put into land to get it out? Were you surprised in writing the book going, right, wow, I never thought about it. I need this much energy to stay alive. I need this much calories, this much food. And were you able to figure out, say, in terms of land, how much you'd need?
Yeah, so in the initial aftermath, you know, when you're waking up the morning after, the night before when the world ended, you're not going to immediately need to go right back to square one, back to basics, and make and do everything for yourself. You'll be able to sort of, for a time, coast on the momentum of the civilization that came before. You can scavenge and forage for what you need. And a related thought experiment that I looked into, which is mathematical, it involved calculations and everything, is asking how long could a average supermarket keep one person alive for? You know, the reason we live in such dense populations of cities nowadays is we've got very, very good at not just growing lots of food, but then preserving it, stopping bacteria and mold from eating something before a person needs to eat it. So I went into a supermarket when I was researching for the book with pen and paper and counted everything on the shelves that was edible and got some very odd looks from people who just
milk. The world's and multiplied all that. Longest game shoplifter.
I was looking very dodgy. You could see the cameras, the security cameras, sort of tracking and following me around the aisles. And multiplied all that together, and divided it by the amount you would need to eat per day to survive. And the calculation comes out that supermarket could keep one person alive for about 55 years.
Okay,
there's enough. Fruit and veg you'd have to eat first before it went off, and then dried pasta and rice, which lasts a bit longer, and then canned food will remain preserved for decades. Or if you really push to it, you could survive for around 63 years by eating all the canned dog food and cat food as well. I don't think I would take it that far. But the point is, there's an awful lot of stuff that'd be left lying around. You'd have this grace period where you could scavenge and forage what you needed to keep yourself alive whilst going through the process of going back to basics and learning and teaching yourself everything you do need to know, such as the fundamentals of farming and agriculture. Now, I don't know, personally, I don't know the first thing about how to walk out into a muddy field with a handful of seeds of grain, chuck it in the ground, and somehow 6 months later have a harvest that will keep me alive. And the tools that you need and the processes you would need to follow. So I explored all that in the book about the basics of farming and how it's such a marvellous system for generating lots of food, for feeding lots of people. Because what you need for society is for the society as a whole to lift itself beyond subsistence level. So not 100% of the people are needed growing food to feed everyone. Mm. You ideally want to get yourself to the situation which we passed in our history, where, say, one person can feed 10 other people, that the farming becomes productive, and those 10 other people can specialise in other skills, whether that's carpentry or mining or metalwork, because now you've got a much more complex society and you can start progressing from there.
And I think, I won't dwell on it because there's so much more I wanted to ask you about, but just that bit that we don't consider that the average human, you know, burns through 3,000 calories a day, but doing what? Like, if all of that is in procuring food, there's literally not even, so A, not enough hours in the day, and B, just not enough energy in the day. I think we all see ourselves as a montage, a bit of food growing, making a cabin.
This rural idyllicism.
Yeah, somehow raising some Swiss Family Robinson children as well too. But we simply don't consider the limitations of say at this latitude, a winter's 8 hours of daylight, or, you know, how much to keep us warm for 16 hours of darkness. That for me was a real, it shouldn't be an eye opener. My eyes should have been open, but it's amazing how much we are blind to what we're sitting upon. And that idea of surplus and one person growing for 10 people, so 10 people can, and they're not sitting watching the farmer. They're, as you say, carpentry, you know, digging drains, all that kind of thing. I really found that fascinating. I thought, as I mentioned earlier, we might go through with a number of kind of key numbers that in a way are signposts to some essential things that we need in society once you figure out there is hope. One of them was simply, you know, pasteurization, like heating, like not dying of milk poisoning. And that as a representative of lots of food purification. So was it 65 to 70 degrees or something? You need to heat.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the key problems, like I say, is not just growing enough to feed yourself and your own family, but also farmers being able to support other people in society so they can specialize. And of course, it's not just getting through the good months, getting through the summer when things grow easily. It's getting through the dry season or winter, depending on where around the world you're living, and thus being able to preserve enough food to get you through perhaps half of a year without growing actively at the time. So not just growing food is critical, but being able to preserve it for long periods and build up a stockpile, build up a reserve that will get you through not just the winter, but perhaps also the following year you might have a very bad harvest, so you need to keep enough back. And milk is one of these products that is so useful in providing energy for the people that drink it. And there's a particularly interesting historical story about when people started dairying, because we are mammals, we drink our mother's milk when we're an infant, but it took a particular evolutionary step where we started drinking other animals' milk, whether that was cows or goats or sheep or camels, to provide us with the sustenance that animal was able to eat. And you can preserve that milk. You can either drink it immediately or preserve it by turning it into yogurt, turning it into cheese, and effectively stopping bacteria and mold growing in that milk and preserving the nutrition for yourself. But in the more modern era, with science starting to get involved, Louis Pasteur developed the process of pasteurization, where you can kill the bacteria which are in the milk, and then you keep it sealed, and it will remain good for a long period of time. And the key temperature there is around 60, 65 degrees. So you've killed the bacteria that are in the milk, but you've not driven chemical changes in the milk, so it starts tasting funny or sort of, you know, modifying its properties. And that's clearly what you're doing with cooking as well. Mm. You are killing the bacteria in the food, so the bacteria can't kill you.
And in order to drink milk, again, just things that I just didn't think about, receptacles and making them. And the most basic receptacle, I presume, is some sort of thing made of the easiest to find material for that might coalesce, clay, but you need to heat it. And that's about 900 degrees. And again,
clay is one of these things that you either just don't bother thinking about because it's boring, or maybe your interaction with it was at, you know, a school sort of arts and craft lesson when you molded a vase for your family or something. But clay is fundamentally an incredibly useful material because you can mold it into any particular shape. You can fire it in a kiln using the heat of fire, turn it into this very refractory, hard, and if you glaze it, a waterproof and airtight material. So this was one of the critical technologies very early in our history that enabled us to protect and preserve food and start building up these reserves. Like if you're trying to store grain, you need to get the moisture out, you need to keep the rats and other vermin out, and a granary filled with clay pots of grain is a very, very good way of doing that. But also having pots allowed us start to boil food. Because if you've got a fire, you can roast, you can sort of like char grill stuff on it. And that works well for meat. It doesn't work particularly well for a lot of vegetables, which you want to cook more slowly in a more controlled manner to help break down the nutrition so that our stomachs can absorb it, but without burning it, without fundamentally changing the sort of texture and the flavour. And clay gave us that capability as well. We could start boiling foods. And these clay pots also seems to have been a critical intermediate step leading up to the discovery of how we can smelt metal, how you get metal out of rock, starting with copper and tin to give us bronze. And then we worked out how to get to much higher temperatures in our kilns and exploit basic understanding of chemistry to get iron out of its ore.
So a long time ago, people noticed that you can fundamentally change, like transmute one material into another by heating it a lot. And they mightn't have known what was going on with covalent bonds or whatever chemistry was behind it, but they just saw, if I put a load of energy into this system in the form of heat,
yeah,
some magic happens. The gods take over and I'm left with this miraculous substance.
Yeah, exactly.
And on that vein, again, we talk about cement. Again, this I suppose in some ways successor to clay, or companion to clay, that we take hugely for granted. It's responsible for so much energy use and carbon footprint and all that kind of thing. But every single job from asking someone around to fix a hole in the wall to, you know, highways requires, again, this incredible burning process.
Yeah.
And what's cement is 1450 degrees or something. What's going on there?
Yeah, so it's something like that. It's a higher temperature than you need for firing clay. It's around the same temperature roughly you need for smelting iron. So once you've been able to technologically achieve those high temperatures, you start unlocking a whole branch of other technologies and capabilities. And again, so cement and concrete are these technologies we just take for granted today, that they're grey, they're boring, your eyes just glaze over them. There are some absolute monstrosities constructed in the 1960s with concrete. But again, when you think about it, it's a miraculous, magical material. It's like liquid stone that you can pour into any particular shape once you've built a mold or a framework for it, and then it sets hard as rock. It's like being able to control rock to build very, very strong, very hard, very rigid structures. And if you start combining the compressive strength of concrete with the flexibility and tensile strength of steel, so when you start making reinforced concrete, you combine the benefits of both those materials and we get, you know, the wonder material of modern reinforced concrete, which is critical for the construction of bridges, of skyscrapers, and, you know, effectively everything you see around you in the modern world. It's made out of this wonder material.
And the bridge, we've no concept of what it must have taken. Well, obviously, archaeologists and historians do. But the idea of going across a fast-flowing river, now we winch sections of bridge into place. But back then, it must have been this endless process of inching out from the bank, building a dam, pumping it out with buckets. Again, all that human labor, those thousands of people needed, and all of that short-circuited by this magic material.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. And I think it's one of the ways that geography absolutely dictated the pattern of human activity, where until you can build very big and very strong and reliable bridges, you're limited to where you can cross rivers. And huge numbers of cities today grew out of villages and towns on a easy crossing point for a river. So where I went to university, Oxford, it is the ford, it is the crossing point of a particular river. And, you know, engineering and our understanding of that and different construction materials leading up to reinforced concrete changed that landscape. We could start building wherever we wanted. But before that, the Romans were masters themselves of concrete construction. And one of the other magical properties of concrete is that it can set even when wet, even when underwater. And that Roman technology gave them capability to build harbours where they needed. You didn't have to rely on what the geography provided for a bay and a safe harbour for your ships. You can build a safe harbour wherever you need one. For whatever military or sort of civilizational reasons, you can just build a harbour out of this wonder material, out of concrete.
I could literally stay talking about the properties of concrete for the next while, but because it's just such a widespread of knowledge in the knowledge in your book. But to shift slightly to none of those people who do all that work and do all the thinking be able to do so if they were beset by disease. And there's two numbers that are fairly crucial. One is related to sterilizing things, and one is in relation to penicillin. So tell me about ethanol and keeping things bacteria-free. And I'm guessing that saved billions of lives.
Yeah, so once you've got a proper understanding of why people get sick, how diseases seem to jump from one person to another, and it's not because of fractious gods cursing you, it's not because of bad air or malaria, as the word came from, but there are things which are so small, they're invisibly tiny, and they get inside your body and they make you sick. They're germs, they're bacteria. And I describe in the book how you can create a simple microscope for yourself to demonstrate the existence of germs. And one of the playful items in the knowledge is, let's say you weren't recovering off an apocalypse, but you had a time machine and you could jump back and whisper something in someone's ear. How much could you change history with, let's say, like a minute of explanation? And the Romans were master concrete makers. They were also master glass makers. And they could form, they created these wonderful vases of very clear glass. They noticed that things look bigger behind a sort of curve of glass. But they never made that next conceptual leap that if you curve glass in a particular way, you can create a lens. You can manipulate light itself. You can build a telescope. You can build a microscope. So imagine how much the history of the world might have changed had the Romans understood why people got sick and understood the importance of preventing germs getting from one person to another. And there's very simple technologies like making soap, which is effectively just mixing animal fat with potash or soda ash. So simple chemistry you can make by trickling water through the ashes of seaweed after you've burnt it or hardwood. You can create soap very easily. But you can also create concentrated ethanol. So brewing and then distillation of the alcohol to much higher concentrations are critical technologies. They are fun because you can get drunk, but they're also really, really useful for a society and a civilization as a whole, because concentrated ethanol is a very good disinfectant. You can use it to sterilize things. And of course, we're all familiar with this from ethanol hand rubs during the coronavirus pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. And there's a brilliant video online, a YouTube channel called How to Make Everything, where he shows how you can make ethanol hand rub to combat coronavirus using Corona beer. So you brew the beer, you get the ethanol, you concentrate that ethanol through distillation, and then you can, you know, mix some sort of other agents with it to get it sort of more of a gel. And you've got this incredible technology for preventing the spread of disease.
I feel like I want to watch all those channels, transcribe them onto some permanent writing material and store them in a locked box underground. We probably won't have time to get into how do we even preserve knowledge and video and photographs and all of that. But then the other thing, I suppose, that saved so many lives, penicillin. In your book, you say 2,000 litres of mould. Is that right? To generate, is it a dose of penicillin?
Yeah, so penicillin and antibiotics is a classic example of serendipity in science technology. Alexander Fleming stumbled across it because he was a bit lazy and messy in his lab, and he popped off on holiday and noticed that bacteria weren't growing around penicillium mould on his agar plates, on his Petri dishes. But it took a long, long while for us to be able to exploit that knowledge and mass produce penicillin antibiotic from mould. And in fact, it only really became commonplace during the Second World War with this massive industrial effort in the United States to stop people dying, not because they've been shot, but because their wound becomes infected and they get septicemia and die from that. And it was quite inefficient at first. You had to grow quite a large volume of, you know, sort of liquid medium, culture medium to get the penicillin growing it, to then try to extract the antibiotic you needed to inject in someone's blood without also injecting a bunch of other crud, which would have triggered an immune response and allergic reaction and you know, made things as bad. So it's one of these stories where the concept behind it is simple. And I explain in the knowledge in the book how you can rediscover antibiotics using just really basic sort of caveman microbiology. But actually the nuance there is that producing enough of it for your society is actually incredibly hard.
So one more specific numbers question, and then a couple of general philosophical ones. One surprising statistic. So we need a load of horses for transport. Let's say we do. But the sheer amount of arable land, say in the United States, up until quite recently, relatively recently, am I right in saying up to a third of arable land was used to grow the food for effectively the transport mechanisms for the horses? Is that right? I'm so surprised it's that much.
Yeah. So before the Industrial Revolution and people realizing that rather than coppicing wood, so not just felling a forest, but managing it so you get a steady, sustainable supply of wood through coppicing. Before we realized you could just dig underground to find ancient fossilized forests in coal seams, society was effectively solar powered. We grew plants and fields to eat ourselves. We grew other crops to feed our livestock, which we either ate or we used as beasts of burden, including things like strong horses to pull the plows, to grow the crops for feeding other horses and feeding ourselves. So the entire network linked together, but it was fundamentally limited by how quickly you could get plants or trees to grow, trees for so firewood, by the sunlight that you don't get any control over. So it was this agrarian society is fundamentally limited by the amount of land you've got access to. And there's competition between farmland for feeding yourself, farmland for feeding the animals that are running your society and doing all the heavy lifting and heavy work for you, and the woodland for creating energy, creating fuel that you could burn. And this continued, this persisted surprisingly late in human history. And even during the Second World War, the horse was a major, major player in pulling around artillery pieces and moving kit and equipment around. And as late as 1915, so in the First World War, something like a third of arable land was used for animals rather than people.
Yeah, and an allied to that is, while we mightn't use animals for necessarily too much, as much transport or as much energy, supplying energy to us, they do supply lots of food to us. So I was struck by the idea that the limiting ability of land to generate food for us, in order to generate lots of food, it needs nitrogen. in order to generate that nitrogen, it needs some sort of manure. But the manure comes from animals who eat the, who eat the plants that we're also competing with. And that led to people trying to, you know, make nitrogen artificially. Again, we will be, people are trying to move away from that kind of artificial nitrogen. But there are some fundamental, I suppose, carrying capacity limits on land when it comes to how do you make calories for lots of people.
Yeah, so we started disconnecting ourselves essentially from the natural ecosystems on the surface of the planet. We disconnected ourselves from needing woodland to create energy and fuel for our society by digging up fossil fuels, which are clearly still natural, but accumulated over millions of years rather than growing sustainably.
And that's spending an inheritance. Like the fossil fuels is, it's made us lazy.
Yes. No, exactly that. But we also disconnected ourselves from the natural nitrogen cycle, which is needed for fertilizer to grow food, and historically came from the poo of the animals we'd fed from the crops we'd grown on the farmland. So it was completing the cycle again. But with the invention of the harbor process and that industrial chemical process, we worked out how to effectively mine the atmosphere, to extract nitrogen from the air and convert it from an inert, unreactive gas into the available form that plant roots need to soak up and grow by turning it to ammonia and then nitrates. And, you know, with many technologies, there's been unintended consequences. There's been knock-on effects, which have ended up being quite negative, with fossil fuels as well as the harbour process, of course. But the harbour process feeds the vast majority of all people alive today.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for that chemical process, billions of people, literally billions of people, would not be here now.
To finish up, some general kind of philosophical questions, having done both this book and indeed throughout other books, such as Being Human, are we, and it seems harsh on us, fundamentally stupider than societies that were able to find their own shelter, like where everybody was some version of agrarian, where people, there were more herbalists per square mile. Again, these are all glib kind of statements I'm making based on no knowledge whatsoever. But is there a real end of empire feel to us where we're so disconnected from the processes that keep us alive? We're just mewling babies in a cot waiting to be taken by a hostile planet.
To be honest, I think not. So whenever I do like sort of a public event or a talk about the knowledge, often the question comes up about, well, look, should we be teaching this kind of stuff at school? Should we be teaching people how to grow their own food, how to work their own tools, how to, you know, smelt their own metal? And my answer to that is always, well, no, because that's not a useful thing for everyone in a society to know. You need some people to know how to do that, but then you need other people to know how to do, you know, perform other important roles in the world that we currently live in. Like a computer programmer is as important as a farmer, because we all rely on each other's labor and products. So what I'm trying to get at with the book is maybe if we all take a bit more appreciation about where things come from. And also I just think it's interesting to know this stuff that I just pick up without a second thought in the shelves of a supermarket. What is its story? What is its history? Where has it come from? Could I do that myself if I wanted to? But on the book's website, which is the-knowledge.org. There's lots of sort of maker projects or how-to guides for if you wanted to, you know, for a weekend's project, you can do some of these things that I did from scratch myself when I was researching the book, from making a selfie in the deepest sense you could ever take a selfie, by mixing together some simple silver-containing chemistry to take a photograph of myself at the back of the book. I made a knife in a 16th century iron forge. I show how you can make your own paper, how you can make your own ink, how you can produce your own book. So there's lots of sort of fun things you can get involved in. Not because you really need to know how to do that in the modern world, but I think the fact that we have become so disconnected with where things come from and how they're made, with the basics of production, we don't really appreciate them. We lose that connection, we lose that satisfaction. If my iPhone breaks, I'll probably just put it in recycling and get a new one without even attempting to have it repaired. And I think we've lost a lot in that. I think recapturing just a little bit of that craft and manual skills and maker skills is deeply fulfilling.
Because this is a maths podcast, I'm just going to bring you back to maths at the end, but don't worry, I'm not quizzing you mathematically speaking, more just a general question. When it comes to something like maths, where you don't need potash or calcium carbonate, some various form of calcium carbonate, and you don't need to supply huge amounts of energy, you maybe somewhere in the deep distant mind, there is equations, but maybe there's nothing. Does knowledge like mathematics spring out of the brain? Like, what? Where is the future of abstract thought, rates of change, or calculus in a society that has forgotten everything? Is it so dependent on detailed observations taken with microscopes and telescopes and pipettes and burettes and time? Or is there pure knowledge that comes out of a brain, even if that brain has been wiped of, you know, it's three generations since the apocalypse? What do you think? Yeah, and, you know, feel free to spoof. It's sort of a bullshit question, but I'm just curious, the pure knowledge, where does it come from if you're starting again, but you're looking at ruins, say?
Yeah. So one of the tricks behind the knowledge, behind this book, which has the conceit that it tells you everything you would need to know to rebuild a society and reboot civilization, it almost entirely neglects mathematics. And in fact, I think I put a single footnote to sort of explain that fact and cover my back and saying, look, maths is a hard thing to describe in a sort of popular science book and make it make sense in the same way that this is how you make soap and stop yourself dying. This is how you smelt metal so you've got tools. But of course, mathematics is as critical to not just our modern world, but through the course of history, as all the other technologies that I do talk about. And that's the reason mathematics was invented in the first place. You know, basic geometry is used for marking out fields. And then it was invented by the Egyptians after their markers were washed away in the Nile flood each time. Basic arithmetic is, of course, important for trade and merchants. Understanding of other aspects of mathematics is important for navigation and measuring the stars and rebuilding the calendar so your agriculture is effective and you can track your progress through time. And you wouldn't have engineering and things like bridges and buildings, you know, big buildings, without an appreciation of the important mathematics behind it. And of course, that includes much of higher level, abstract, conceptual things like rates of change and differentials and integrals. They are tools in the same way as an iron axe is for chopping down a tree. It is utterly critical. And so I wonder if, you know, if you play the ultimate version of this game, that the hardest way an apocalypse could happen, and everything is just ruins now, and it's generations later, maybe even centuries later, before people start trying to rebuild. And this is explored in books like A Canticle for Leibowitz, where a sect of monks are trying to keep alive just a glimmer of that ancient knowledge, and they're just mindlessly copying out texts, and the understanding and the knowledge behind it has been lost. So if you're starting from an absolute hard reset, how quickly would things like mathematics reemerge? And like you say, I don't have a good answer for that. But I think it's an interesting thing to you know, maybe ponder next time you're in the shower.
Yeah.
And your mind is wandering.
I mean, and then just purely speculating, it's funny, like you mentioned the book with the monks. Is it a bit like religion and the Dark Ages, where presumably at some point illiterate people were copying things in some hope that one day its truths might be unveiled? So is the closest analogy maybe religion, or like where you're, it becomes symbolic and sacred until somebody kind of finds a Rosetta Stone and goes, wait a minute, this is a 10 times tables.
Yeah, so religion and all history is a good way of preserving knowledge in the long term. If it's given value above and beyond the content of itself, people are more likely to tell each other and pass it down generations. The problem with that, however, one of the problems, is it stops people questioning that handed down knowledge. You stop questioning and challenging the received wisdom and just agree with it, just believe it. And so it was a transformative moment in sort of European history, at least, with the Renaissance, with people not just trying to preserve and keep alive the ancient knowledge, but challenging it and then pushing beyond it.
Yeah.
And so, again, and you know, this is very speculative, but if there were to be an apocalypse, even worse than the collapse of the Western Roman Empire and the Dark Ages from that, might a good strategy, if you see this coming, try to enshrine what you believe to be the most critical information for keeping people healthy, helping a fledgling civilization emerge at some point in the future by giving them 10 commandments. Mm. Like, do this, do this. This is the most critical stuff to not forget. And again, you know, science fiction has already been exploring these ideas with Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what he talks about. It's one of the ideas I play around with in the knowledge.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, one side effect of reading your book is I find it so hard to throw things away because everything looks like a miracle of precision engineering. And I am completely on board with the new plastic bottle lids that stay stuck to the bottles. Everybody's giving out, complaining about them. But I'm like, this is a miracle of...
It kind of makes sense.
Of screw, of spiral technology.
Yeah.
It just made me look at every mundane thing and go, that is perfectly measured. Thank you for helping me see the world, the mundane world, in as a beautiful miracle. Hopefully we'll never, ever need your book. but it is definitely something that has made me change how I see the world. And obviously the current one is Being Human still the current one, or is there even more coming out?
Yeah, Being Human is the latest one published. It came out in paperback in the UK this summer, just gone by. And I'm just signing the deal with the publishers for the next book. So watch this space.
You can't say what that's about yet.
So it's moving on from sort of big history narratives that I explored with the knowledge and then origins and then Being Human. And I'm now looking into exploring aspects of human ingenuity,
okay,
clever ideas for solving a particular problem.
Adding to the archive of knowledge that needs to be placed in a seed vault somewhere in the Arctic yes. Circle, maybe.
There's actually a copy of the knowledge in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault.
Really?
All the seeds you would need to reboot agriculture.
Yeah.
It was a GitHub project, and they've put a copy of my book, The Knowledge, along with other books in a sort of apocalyptic library. Incidentally, and this is going to sound way too egotistical, there's also a copy of the knowledge on the surface of the moon,
wow,
etched microscopically into titanium plates to have been preserved, a library of humanity,
okay,
on the lunar surface.
On the other hand, you have just given the alien civilization the keys to our city.
Yeah. Although the irony is, if you have the technological capability of getting to the moon, you probably don't need that basic stuff in terms of how to sort metals and make soap and invent the microscope.
One rocket, though. One rocket taking off before it all explodes, a la Don't Look Up. Okay, thank you so much, Lewis. And that was fascinating. And I'm looking forward to reading the rest of Being Human and further examples of human ingenuity. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a fun chat. Cheers.
Thanks so much to Lewis Dartnell there. Not only was The Knowledge a worldwide bestseller, he has a website to go with it, the-knowledge.org, where he has a go at making things that you might need after the fall, including an apocalypse-proof Kindle, which charges itself with its own little solar panels. The next episode is called The High Seas, and I'll be releasing that very shortly. This is a great book about a thing you think you know but actually haven't really thought about properly. The High Seas, Greed, Power and Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean with Olive Heffernan. It's about the sea, the ocean, the high seas. It's sheer awesome beauty, scale and craziness. So looking forward to that. Thanks again to Lewis.